Hello, welcome to Late to It. I'm Naomi Frisby.
I'm Kirsty Dill.
And this is the 50th episode of Reading Books at the Right Time.
We have been late to 100 books.
We have. That's a lot of reading.
That's a lot of books to be late to. Are we on time to anything is the question.
Probably not, but there are many, many more books on my shelf that we can use. Oh dear.
50th, pal.
Yeah. Well done, us.
Yeah.
Not bad for people products. Started in lockdown.
And people still seem to listen to it, which is very nice of them.
Yes, currently. So we've put the Sex Week episode out the week we're recording this, which is going to sound weird if you're listening to it. But we're recording episode 8, and episode 4 has just come out. Sex Week's very popular.
Very popular. We see you guys. We see you. Very much noted.
Oh dear. So Kirsty, what have you been reading on time this week?
Well, I've been reading a book about a gay mountain lion in LA.
That doesn't sound like your thing at all.
So I've been reading Open Throat by Henry Hoke, which sounds like a weird poem. Open Throat by Henry Hoke, which was published this year by Picador. It's a very slim little book. I mean, I can never quite figure out what the definition between a novella and a novel is, but it's either a novella or a very short novel. And it is told from the perspective of a queer mountain lion living in the Hollywood Hills, just going about his business. And it's sort of based on a true story, which... I mean, I don't know the lion's particular sexuality or indeed gender identity, but there was a kind of big cat who was sort of on the loose in LA, I think in the 90s, and it became a whole thing. And
oh yeah,
yeah, people were like trying to like basically kept a load of journalists in business by writing all these articles about this Hollywood lion. That was gadding about until it was eventually captured and euthanized, I think. But yeah, so it sort of takes that idea of this sort of almost mythic type beast who is, and the whole thing's told from his perspective. It's all kind of first person narration, first lion narration. So you see him, you know, he's hungry. A lot of it, you know, the start of the book is very much the lion trying to, you know, eat, like, probably wouldn't eat a child, but, you know, he observes hikers, you know, who don't see him. He overhears bits of conversations. He doesn't quite understand all the words and all this sort of stuff. And eventually, for various reasons, he leaves the Hollywood Hills and goes down into the city, and ends up being taken in by the daughter of a kind of celebrity, like comedian actor type. And, you know, she's in her late teens, I think, and is moody and all this sort of stuff. And so decides to keep this lion in her house because obviously, and it just kind of goes on from there. And it's sort of what happens as this lion starts living in LA. And I mean, it's all sort of, you know, there's loads of metaphors for, you know, how we treat animals and how we treat humanity. And sort of there's a whole kind of myth section where the lion goes to Disneyland, and there's stuff about hunger and scarcity, and you know, there's sort of loads of politics underneath it, but on the front of it, it's also just a really fun novel about a mountain lion who goes to Disneyland. It's great. It's really good fun. It's slightly batshit. It's got loads of things. It's one of those things where you go, this is mad, but also it's got quite a lot of things to say, and it's really short and very quick read. So I highly recommend it.
It sounds great. Some of my favourite books are narrated by or involve talking bears, so I'm quite happy to branch out into talking lions.
I'm amazed that there's plural.
Oh, there's loads. Like, it's a whole genre, Kirsty. I love it.
Okay, what? tell me about the talking bear.
Bear comes home, Raffi Zabor. Come on, this is like classic stuff. You must have read this.
Yeah. Have I?
So it's from about 20 years ago. I read it on my master's degree. He plays jazz. It's fucking brilliant.
I don't think I have read that.
There's also Memoirs of a Polar Bear. I'm sure that's
No.
what it's called. Hang on, just looking this up so I can tell you. Yeah, Memoirs of a Polar Bear by Yoko Tawada. Tawada? Yep. Love that one. Absolutely love it. What else was I thinking of? I don't think the bear talks in Marion Engel's Bear. I think.
That's the way my head of re but that's one of many books that I've got and haven't read yet.
Yeah, she has sex with it, but I don't think it talks. as you
Fair
do.
play.
Yeah, there are multiple Talking Bear books.
Wow.
I love them. There's also, I mean, there's Talking Flies. You know the one in Rebecca Miller's books? Is it Jacob's Folly? So I'm not a big fan of Rebecca Miller. Yeah, I don't know how people feel about her work generally, but I didn't like. So her first novel I didn't like at all, really. But the second one, I'm sure it's called Jacob's Folly, is partly narrated by a fly, and it is brilliant.
I have, there's a whole genre here that I have completely passed by.
Oh, there's loads of books narrated by animals. I love them. I'm well into them.
Well, I know there's books narrated by animals, but I hadn't quite
Right.
realized how many bears.
Yeah, there's definitely a bear thing.
Maybe next series we're going to have to be late to some talking animals.
Yeah,
The
why
other
not?
one in my head is the bees.
The one that was on the Women's Prize list.
That what her new one was, Pod.
Yeah, the bees. I'm sure I read the bees because it was on the Women's Prize list as well.
I was extremely pregnant, and I probably wasn't paying because I was on maternity leave and I wasn't paying attention to what was on lists. Fascinating time. So that probably was on, but I can't remember. But I did love that book.
I enjoyed it. It was slightly too long, but I enjoyed it. Yeah, why not? Let's do some talking animals next soon.
Okay, I'm gonna have to, yeah, that's set me off on a tangent. Maybe we should put Bear. Oh, you've already read it. I need to read
Oh,
Bear.
I will happily read Bear again. It's brilliant.
Oh, fine, let's do Bear next series. We've decided live on the podcast.
Yeah.
Some next series we'll be late. Well, Naomi will be less late than me, but I will be very late to Bear.
I mean, I was pretty late to it because I'm sure it came out in like the 70s originally or something, and I read it like 2 or 3 years ago. I read it just before Dawn
Issues, wasn't it?
reissued it. Yeah, I've got an older copy that I've got a secondhand copy that I'd bought before they picked it up. But their version has got a really nice cover on it.
That's the version I've got, the Dawn Books version, and it is great.
Yeah. Well, we've gone on a total tangent, but hey ho, talking animals for the win.
Talking Animals Week. Looking forward to it. So what have you been reading? Were there any talking animals in it?
There were not any talking animals in it, but it's named after an animal.
Okay,
I've
close
been
enough.
reading The Coiled Serpent by Camilla Gradova.
Ah, this is a book I'm a bit familiar with.
Yes, so I just want to point out that Kirsty's the publicist for this book. She has not like threatened me in any way or paid me
No,
to
and I, in fact,
talk
didn't
about
know
it.
that's what you'd chosen until this very moment.
No, because we didn't talk about it. But I've read it this week because I've interviewed Camilla along with Natalie Ola at Blackwell's Manchester. Shout out to David, who I know has listened to podcast and read, both of them listen to podcasts. So hello guys.
Hello.
Yes. So I just want to mention Natalie's book quickly because her book that's just come out is called Bad Taste with Dialogue Books, and it's all about taste and class and who decides what's tasteful and how those things happen and what that means in terms of consumerism as well. She is a brilliant like political thinker basically. She's also very funny, and bits of the book include like memoir bits that are really not always funny, but there are some bits that are sort of funny. And so it's a really interesting read, and she was great to interview, and she's good friends with Camilla, which is why they were on the same bill, but also because The Coiled Serpent, I don't know whether you'd call it distasteful, but there are some moments in it that are, well, I say some moments, right? I wrote a list actually. I've thrown my notes away, but I had a list of all the like bodily functions in it. So there is an awful lot of shit. oh, This piss, I'm going to read a bit, just a tiny little bit where somebody pisses in a minute. The fair warning if you want to skip. Vomiting, there's menstrual blood, there's other blood, there is semen. There is semen.
Or not, as the case may be.
There is semen retention as well. Have I missed anything? Not sure, probably. There's plenty
there's
of
blood. Lots of kind of sloughed off skin.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I can't get over the cleaning out block toilets with a teaspoon. Ugh. But the stories are completely fucking brilliant. I really, really enjoyed them. And I don't, like, we did Doll's Alphabet on the, I think, the was it the first series of the podcast, second series?
The second series. It was actually before, it was before the publisher that I worked for had signed her next book. So read Doll's Alphabet, not knowing that a little while later I'd end up being her publicist. So I'm extremely fortunate and a genuine fan.
So I should point out, Shana, that this is published by Atlantic.
It is. Like,
in case you weren't
fabulous mentioned. Publishing house.
Yes, that's who you work for. So yeah, the difference of Doll's Alphabet. So if you've read, I mean, you have because you're a publicist, and I have because I interviewed her about it. But if you, the listener, has read Children of Paradise, which is Camilla's novel, this is sort of more in line with Children of Paradise, I think, or maybe some sort of combination of two, but more aligned, but definitely more aligned with the novel. So there's lots of stuff about food. There are two stories that involve custard powder. One of which involves a fire at a custard factory, and the story sort of unravels for you to discover how the fire happened. Like, some of the endings are just brilliant. The like reveals or the twists at the end of the stories are just absolutely brilliant. There's some poisoning that goes on, which is partly to do with some custard. Birds custard cops for it at that point. The Coil Serpent, the title story, I mean, I could talk about loads of these, but The Coil Serpent, the title story, is about these three young tech bros who live in a flat together, and they read this pamphlet. And I asked Camilla about this, and she said, it's on 4chan, this is a real thing, which doesn't surprise me. And what it tells them that they need to do is basically to return their semen, to not be like, as Natalie put it the other day, wasting it in any of those, like, you know, useless women, or, you know, just spunking it out wherever. They've got to return the semen. And I can't give away the ending because it's too good and it would be awful to spoil it for people, but it is just brilliant. The story before that is this whole thing where these girls get shipped off to Madame Flora's when their periods stop.
Oh, yeah.
And they have to wear these, like, ridiculous... Everybody wears these ridiculous snappy bustles, like, all women. So, like, men can't tell whether you're on your period or not. And I very much enjoyed this little detail. Victoria knew the right amount she could piss in her bustle without it leaking or smelling. She did so. There weren't many public bathrooms for women. I just very much enjoyed that little detail. It reminded me of... Have you seen the... I'm sure it was Tom Gold. There was a Tom Gold cartoon that had... women dressed in, like, you know, the big the Victorian dresses with the sort of bustles, and there was a woman pissing in the street because she could get away with it because she couldn't see anything underneath, and it reminded me of that. Anyhow, what else have we got? Loads about food, loads about houses. Oh, particularly enjoyed there's one set in a pool that is grim. Oh, so I should mention there are multiple murders. There is cannibalism.
All the best books have it.
Yes, definitely selling this to people, Kirsty.
Sell it to me. If I hadn't already read it, being publicised it, I'd be all over this.
I know full well I'm selling it to a certain sort of listener, and they are our listeners. We know this because they're still here after 50 episodes. The pool centre had a special swimsuit designed for Queen Victoria, a complex and modest filled black costume of cotton, rubber and cotton with a matching cap. At the pool opening, she was briefly submerged like a diving bell spider or enormous dark floating turd before being pulled out by her servants. So the whole collection sort of a reaction to when Camilla moved to the UK, and sort of her uncanny off-kilter observations about this weird little island. And they are, weird stories, but also really just like fascinating, sometimes funny. I mean, I love her as a writer. I think there's an element of this is not a comment on Camilla, this is a comment on the stories. There is an element of absolute batshit about this, and I love it. So yeah, highly recommend. Came out last week, I think, was it?
2nd of November.
Yeah. Well,
Yes, it did.
last week when we're recording. It'd be like a month ago by the time this comes out. But yeah, she if and if you're if you haven't come across Camilla because you haven't listened to our episode, which you need to do now, obviously, she was on the best of Young British Novelists, the Granta list this year as well. So there you
And
go.
did for the Women's Prize.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, any praise that I give will sound insincere because I'm the book's publicist. But as I said just now, I was a fan of Camilla's writing before I was lucky enough to work on. Well, I did publicity for Children of Paradise and for Porter. Camilla is a delight. I love her. I think she's fabulous. And yeah, these the highest compliment I can pay is these absolutely disgusting stories, and I love them. Utterly brilliant. And yeah, I'm thrilled, and I didn't even have to like ask you to do that. So that's a genuine praise that I didn't even. And I've just got something actually to put on my coverage report. So thanks very much for that.
Delighted to help you out. Do I get a share of your bonus?
She laughs hollowly.
Was going to say, that's what my boyfriend refers to as my insincere laugh, Kirsty. That's not a real laugh.
Publishing.
Laugh.
Steady on. Right, on that happy note then. Infidelity week.
Apparently. And I think I picked both of these, so I'm just like, what the fuck was I thinking?
Yes, no, these were both yours. Loved them both, I have to say. Two very, very different books.
Oh,
Both
yeah.
of them deal with infidelity and the fallout of it, but they deal with it very, very different ways. So the first book we're going to talk about is Standard Deviation by Katherine Heine, which I probably quite a few people that are listening to this might already have read, because it's definitely been one of those books that has, I know loads of people who have read it. That was published by Fourth Estate in 2017. And the other book we are going to talk about is The Harpy by Megan Hunter, which was published in 2020 by Picador. So yeah, Standard Deviation. I have not read anything by Katherine Heine before. I've got friends and colleagues who have raved about Early Morning Riser. And I definitely, as I said, I definitely know people that have read this and loved it. But I hadn't read it, and actually, I have to say, I was sort of slightly trepidatious to reading it because simply because so many people I know had been raving about it, and ironically, for a publicist, it's like, you know, when someone loads of people have been raving about your book, and you're going to go, oh, what if I don't like it? And so I went into this slightly fearful that I would be sitting here going, oh, I don't get the hype. But I actually really, really, really enjoyed it, and not unconditionally. I think there are flaws. And one particular thing which I will go on to talk about, which sort of rankled with me, but on the whole, I thought it was very, very funny. I mean, genuinely laughed out loud on a couple of occasions. And you know, lots of heart. Actually, in some ways, it reminded me of Less, which I talked about last week, by Andrew Sean Greer, just in terms of that kind of tonally. The kind of humor that it's got. But briefly, what the book is about is a couple called Graham and Audra, who have been married for, they've got a 9-year-old son, I think, at that point. So they've been married for a decade or something. That you find out very early on that their relationship was actually an affair. Graham was married to another woman called Elspeth. Graham had an affair with Audra, left Elspeth for Audra, and as is now married to the woman that was his mistress. They have a son called Matthew. We also see Elspeth. So for various reasons, Elspeth ends up coming back into Graham's life. And him and Audra sort of end up with this sort of slightly weird double dating thing between her and her boyfriend Bentrup, who we will talk about. And then there's this other kind of cast of subsidiary characters, friends of Audra, called Laura Lee and Doug, and then an ever, just a revolving door of house guests, which is all part of Audra's people collecting, which we'll get onto. But yeah, it's although not flawless, I thought a very, very good book and a very funny one. What did you think?
I thought it was very good. I kind of came at it from a slightly different angle to you, I think, in that I knew loads of people who'd loved it as well. It seems very much like she's a writer's writer, like everyone I know who loves us in like either in publishing or rights or whatever. So I was expecting to really love it. So I didn't love it as much as I thought. I'm going to make a really unoriginal observation about her and say it very much reminded me of Nora Ephron. And I think part of the problem was that I love Heartburn. I absolutely love Nora Ephron's Heartburn. So this was always going to pale next to that, I think, if we're like talking about funny books about infidelity, although I'll tell you that I don't think Heartburn's that funny, to be honest. And I sobbed my heart out at the end. So, but yeah, I did enjoy it. I did think there were bits where I did laugh out loud. I don't know whether you want to do the jokes this early on, the filthy. All the ones that I thought were hilarious were filthy. Basically, if it's about sex, I think it's hilarious. Read into
This
that
is
what
why
you
the
will.
sex episode's doing so well.
Shall I just read them? Because these are
Edit.
it, honestly. So really early on, they go to this wedding and it's a bit so Audra's whole thing with these sort of random house guests, and she talks to everybody. So she ends up at this wedding, which I think is something to do with them wanting a particular doctor to do something. Like she knows everybody. Go on.
It was the doctor that delivered Matthew,
Yep.
who she'd reconnected with because she was trying to. He was on the board of the building that
Yes,
Elspeth
the
wanted
Elspeth
to move
building.
into. So she rang him up, going, "I don't know if you remember me." And he was like, "I very much do remember you. You would not
So
stop talking."
there's a bit near the beginning, right at the beginning, where Graham says that he just can't follow what the fuck. Like Audrey bumps into someone in a supermarket and he can't follow it, right? And this is like when I start up a story and my boyfriend goes, "There are too many names in this. I've got no idea what you're talking about." It's that. But yeah, so they get to this wedding, and Graham says, "Tell me the bride and groom's names again," Graham whispered to Audra as soon as an usher had seated them. "Brian and Michelle," Audra said in her normal speaking voice. "Brian went to law school at Georgetown and now he works in multi-something finance in Boston. And Michelle, I know virtually nothing about her," Audra said, "except that she gets very wet during sex." Like, what the fuck? Then there's this bit. So Elspeth's husband, Ben Trupp, who is a bit of an odd cat, he reminded me of, like, I don't know, very sort of English. That's what he made me think of, a very sort of English, like, because he dresses in a particular way, doesn't he? He's very, I don't know, Noel Cowardish, but not gay. And they're having a conversation about, and this is Audra's word, not mine, they're having a conversation about hookers. And so she thinks it'd be the worst job in the world, da 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 da. And Ben Trupp, oh, I think they've been thinking, she's been wondering about to Graham before this happens about what kind of sex Elspeth and Ben Trupp might have, right? Which I don't think is like out of the realm, maybe this is me. I don't think it's out of the realms of possibility that people discuss what other people's sex lives might be like. However, so they're having this dinner and they're talking about sex workers. And she goes, "If you were to go to a hooker, though," Audra said to Ben Trupp in a slow, considering voice, "what all would you ask for?" Again, what the fuck? And the last one, which is, I don't know, I sort of was like, not, I don't know, trying not to laugh at this because there's a whole like, what on earth? So she doesn't know towards the end that Graham and Elspeth have been sort of having this like emotional affair, basically. She knows that Graham's like, well, they meet up as a foursome for a while. And then I think she probably does know that they're meeting up and having dinner. It's not quite clear, but I don't think she realizes quite sort of how far it's gone, although they haven't had sex. And spoiler, Elspeth's dead at this point because it doesn't make sense if you, I don't think if you don't know that. So, and So Audra's expecting at the funeral for someone to turn up and be really sort of obviously like Elspeth's last lover. As far as I know, there hasn't been anyone since Bentrop, Graham said carefully. I think she was going through a dry spell. Audra looked at him in astonishment. What? No sex at all? I don't think so. Not even a one-night stand with a drunk migrant worker she picked up in a bar or something. Graham couldn't imagine anyone less likely to do that than Elspeth. He shook his head. I don't think anyone touched her, he said. Well, I had dry spells when I was single too, Audra said. But those were times when I didn't have a steady boyfriend. I mean, there were still men who touched me, and then some. Mercifully, the taxi pulled up to their building. Graham paid the driver and Audra hopped out to hug Julio, who was on duty. And then there was the mail to collect and homework to supervise and dinner and dishes and all that stuff you do every day that sometimes seems pleasurable and sometimes seems pointless, but never seems to end. Later that night in bed, when they turned off the lights and the darkness of their bedroom was as soft and deep as mink fur, Audra sighed. I hope Elspeth was at least fingered by a drunk migrant worker, she said. Graham pretended he was already asleep. Just like, what the fuck?
Well, this is the thing about Audra. She's got no boundaries. She's got absolutely no filter and no, I mean, she can't see the boundaries. Boundaries do not exist to her. And it's, I think while we were saying this before we started recording, in real life, like she would absolutely do my head in. But as a character in a book, I sort of loved her because she was so ridiculous.
Yeah.
And yeah, just the fact that she doesn't know anything about the woman at the bride at the wedding, other than, you know, she gets really wet during sex. And then there's this wonderful this comedy moment where the elderly couple down the aisle are just like, you can see them sort of jolt as they've overheard her. And Audra is this kind of people collector. Like wherever she goes, you know, she within 5 minutes will have everyone's sort of deepest, darkest secret or, you know, personal anecdote. And Graham is sort of bamboozled about it. But actually what was very charming, I thought, was Graham clearly adores Audra. And there's lots of kind of, as you alluded to, there's a moment where it's possible that he might start having an affair with his ex-wife, although he doesn't in the end. And there's a point where Audra's attention is wandering as well. But they, despite being very, very different people, sort of just seem to work together. And Graham is at turns completely exasperated with her, utterly baffled by her, but also slightly in awe of her and her ability to just go in and chat to someone and, you know, have made 10 new friends, you know. And I totally get that, because I am not that person. I'm not the sort of person that can go to a party. Well, I'm not the kind of person that goes to a party for a start, but you know, the kind of person that goes to a party and comes home with like 10 new best mates and 3 coffee dates and play date for the kids kind of thing. I've just never been that sort of person. So I sort of very much was with him watching this whirlwind of a woman sort of just flying about New York, collecting people as she went. And I think, so sort of, I'm going to use that as a moment to sort of talk about my problem with the book. So their son, Matthew, is autistic. And as the book goes on, and you can see that obviously they've known this for a while. There's lots of references to what it's like parenting a special needs child, what it's like, you know, finding the small wins where you can, and all this sort of stuff that I, you know, as a parent of 2 autistic children, sort of very much recognised. But first and foremost, consistently they refer to Asperger's, which is, I have to point out, a phrase, you know, a term that is let's just say falling out of fashion because of connotations with Asperger himself, who had a slight issue with working with Nazis, which was less than ideal. And there's sort of, there's quite a few references to high functioning and low functioning. And, you know, these are all terms that if you aren't sort of in the orbit of of autism or autistic people, you may not realize that those terms are not great terms to use. But I do have to flag, I feel I need to flag that. But the thing that happens sort of as the book goes on is that I think both Graham and Audra are sort of more and more coming to terms with Matthew as he is, and he gets in with this really charming origami club where he's the only child, and it's all adult men that are clearly autistic that all sit there talking about very nerdy folding things. And that's very charmingly done. But there's kind of increasing conversations as the book goes on between Audra and Graham about whether they are Aspergers or very Aspergery, which sort of made me wince a little bit and sort of do that kind of ugh. But I obviously, as I was sitting there reading it, was diagnosing people as I went. And Audra has absolutely no understanding of social boundaries. And while that is a kind of cliched idea of autism, there is absolutely an element of not necessarily knowing what polite society would classify as knowledge that you just kind of announce at a wedding. It was used for comedy effect, but I think quite well. It was very funny. And Graham sort of is thinking about himself and his love of routine and that sort of thing. But it wasn't ever referenced, but Audra was clearly ADHD. I was sort of screaming at the page, going, "She's got ADHD, she can't concentrate on anything. She's doing 15 different things at once. The woman is classic." I don't know if that was Heine's intention, but I would like to say that I've diagnosed her and probably could go through the diagnostic tick box form and yeah, definitely. So that was my main sticking point with the book, was just sort of outdated terminology. But what stopped me from being out and out like they've used all the wrong terminology is that I could absolutely expect that Graham and Audra are the kind of people who would use that terminology and would sit there going, "Oh God, why can't our son be normal?" And all of that sort of stuff. And while there is a moment towards the end where Graham goes sort of internally, "God, I wouldn't change him. Like I need to like just kind of understand, just all absorb, they people change over time, and you can't force people to be something they're not." And he sort of has this bit of a moment where he kind of goes, "I love him so much exactly as he is." There are lots of bits through the book where you're just like, "Oh, that's a bit there's a little wince factor." But oh, I'm absolutely rambling now, sorry.
No, you don't need to apologize. There were bits that there were bits when I thought, I wonder what Kirsty thinks about this. I was wincing at bits and thought, is it because I'm looking at it from a purely theoretical point of view, I guess. But there were the bits when they were like, yeah, they just wanted him to be a bit different, and I was like, oh no, don't do that. But like you said, they're the sort of people that I could, and I'm sure there are some people who like feel like that, then have a really hard time coming to terms with it.
Oh, for sure, absolutely, definitely. But and there are moments that are really charmingly done. So, like the first time they leave him at the origami club, and they're really worried about him eating because there are very, very specific things that he will eat, and that's something I'm very familiar with my son, of certain brands and certain things and things done in a certain way. And Pearl, who's Clayton, who runs the club. Pearl, his wife, just doesn't bat an eyelid and goes, "Well, Manny only eats white things, and why don't you just come into the kitchen and tell me how he likes his sandwiches made?" And that sort of that kind of palpable relief of going, "All right, someone who gets it." And that I think was very, very well done. Of yes, finding people that get it, and don't bat an eyelid, where you go, "Well, the sandwiches absolutely cannot be square." otherwise bad things will happen. those bits were really well done, but there were other bits where it was just like, oh God, I wish you hadn't said that.
Yeah, I think one of the things I liked about Matthew, and I think actually this is probably true of the book as a whole, is that so he doesn't change the circumstances around, so he finds places where he fits in, which are really nice. And I think that's Audra and Graham don't change. I don't think, like, you know, normally you'd expect character growth in a book, and I'm not sure there is any, but like there's something else she's doing with things around them shifting rather than them changing as people.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but you're absolutely right. The circumstances around them change, and they are constantly in this sort of getting more distant and coming back together and getting more distant and coming back together. There's a lot of instances of sort of love and loss and people losing people. It's not just, say, when Elspeth dies or when romantic relationship ends or sexual relationships end. There's also, you know, friendships that change, you know, and alter over time. Although, you know, there's no getting away from the fact that there's just infidelity absolutely everywhere. In fact, thinking about the list of characters, I think there's only, is it only Lorelei and Doug or Lorelei and Doug who don't, there's no infidelity? Because
Think
obviously Graham and Audra, Ben Trupp is unfaithful to Elspeth, which is why they break up. Loads of spoilers here.
so.
Even in a way, there's a sort of really sad bit where Matthew's made a friend and the friend sort of dumps him for another friend. It's almost a type of infidelity there, even if it's not a kind of reliant, there's like a friendship infidelity kind of thing. Bitsy, who's one of the house guests, her husband is unfaithful. It's just absolutely rampant.
Yeah, and I was reading this going, I take a really dim view of infidelity. Why the fuck did I pick it? Yeah, so some of those bits really annoyed me. Just that was just personal thing. That's not, I'm sure loads of people can read books about infidelity without like batting an eyelid, but I was just like, oh, for fuck's sake, here we go. And also, I didn't feel when it sort of, so when Audra wanders, I sort of went, well, what the fuck do you expect? Like, I didn't really have much sympathy for either of them because I was like, well, what do you expect? You two got together because you were unfaithful. Though.
But they're not very sympathetic characters, I don't think. I like them, but I didn't feel sympathetic towards them.
No.
The only person, the only adult, Matthew aside, the only adult I felt genuinely sort of sympathetic towards was Elspeth, who
Oh no,
was
I've been. Go on, sorry.
well, because she was just sort of trying to be herself. Like, she's wildly different to any other character in the book. She's very straight-laced, she's very proper, she likes things done properly. And Graham is a bit more like that, but obviously Graham's, you know, Graham's also got the edge of Audra kind of thing. Elspeth was just trying to do her thing and live her life. Now, obviously, there's the almost affair with Graham later in the book, which is sort of a bit of an aberration. But that aside, I sort of did feel slightly sorry for her in that she just seemed to be most of the time the one that the infidelity kept happening to.
Yeah, I get that. But the one that I really liked was Julio, who's one of the house guests and got mentioned in that quote because he's the doorman. And there's a right palaver at one point about why, talking of those like stories where everybody gets mentioned, where he ends up back living with them for the second time because someone's coming to stay in someone else's. There's a whole like family palaver about who's staying where, and everyone's sort of been displaced, so he ends up back in the house. Yeah, but I enjoyed Julio, and he has a like he sort of slots into the family really nicely,
Yeah, he does.
and he gets on really well with Matthew as well. He just takes him as he is and is lovely to him, and yeah, so I liked Julio.
He's the kind of most easygoing character because he just sort of fits in with everyone else and just chats to whoever and, you know, kind of gets on with it. Whereas everyone else is quite, he's the one that isn't highly strung.
Yeah.
Whereas everyone else is very highly strung.
Everyone else can have one of those t-shirts that says high maintenance on them.
Exactly. exactly. But I did really enjoy it. I did think it was very, very funny. Infidelity, but make it funny.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it. I got a couple of her other books, and I look forward to reading those. Hopefully, infidelity less books.
Report back next
Yeah,
series.
will do.
So the other book we're going to talk about is also infidelity, but not hilarious. This is very much
I
not
don't know.
funny. Well, yeah, very different sort of funny then. So this is The Harpy by Megan Hunter, which, as I said, was published in 2020 by Picador. I have not read her anything else by her. This is the first thing I've read by her, and I did absolutely love it. It is a very different book, very, very dark. And angry, and is about a couple, Lucy and Josh Stevenson, who have gone, they've been married, they've got together very young, they've been married for quite a while. They've got two little boys called Paddy and Ted. And you find out at the beginning of the novel that Josh has been having an affair with one of his colleagues, Vanessa. He's an academic, they both work in the same department. Vanessa is, I think, a little bit older, and has recently moved to the department. And yeah, so they've been having this affair, and Lucy finds out because Vanessa's husband, David, phones her one evening and tells her. So that's sort of the basic premise. And Lucy has always been sort of fascinated with, has studied the harpy, from which I had to look up exactly what it was. I sort of knew vaguely what it was, but in mythology, the harpy is a kind of half bird, half woman creature, that tends to come in and sort of eviscerate people, essentially. The line I found describing them were, they were generally depicted as birds with the heads of maidens, their faces pale with hunger, and long claws on their hands. And in the book, what Lucy says is, I asked my mum what a harpy was. She told me that they punish men for the things they do. And so when Josh is unfaithful, Lucy goes full harpy and starts to punish Josh. And there is an agreement that she will hurt him three times. And she does that in quite imaginative ways, frankly. But yeah, I loved it. It's furious and dark and bleak, and it's sort of darkly funny at times, but it's a very, very angry book. But you've read some of her previous stuff, haven't you?
Yeah, I haven't. I'm pretty sure that she writes poetry, and I haven't read any poetry, but I read The End We Start From multiple times. I love that book, and it's quite a short book and fairly like easy to read. And it's basically, it's a set in an apocalypse, and this woman gives birth, and she gets split up with her husband, split up from her husband. And there's not much else to it apart from that, apart from she's trying to get somewhere where she's safe and will possibly be reunited with him, she hopes. But it's a metaphor for like the early stages of motherhood. It's absolutely fucking brilliant. And is about to come out as a film with Jodie Comer in it. I mean, imagine having Jodie Comer in a fucking film version of your book. So I'll be going to see it because I'm very excited about it. Yeah, so I've read her before, and I loved The Harpy as well. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. And also reminded me of Sarah Hall, which is like the highest compliment, is it not? So I
Yeah.
thought very reminiscent of Hall's work.
I'll second that.
Yeah, where to start? I think I'm going to start by saying there's no way I can talk about this without doing spoilers. You've been warned, people. Because we've got to talk about the stuff that she does to Josh. I fucking hated Josh. I hated him.
No
Absolutely.
redeeming features whatsoever.
No, I mean, he's an academic, end of. Like,
I'm
number
going to
one.
say he's a man, end of.
Well, that's two strikes against him. Yeah, so they come to this agreement, and the first thing she does is brilliant because it's the whole, you get the sort of sense because there's a little, oh, I was going to say a preview then. That's not the word that I want. What's the bit at the beginning of the book?
Prologue.
Prologue. See, I knew it starts with the same letter. So there's a prologue where they've done that thing where they've taken a bit from later on in the book. So he's clearly agreed to what's happening at that point, but it turns out that's the last thing she does to him. So the first thing she does to him is, in fact, the first two things, she doesn't tell him she's going to do it. So
No.
the first one, she poisons his dinner. It's just, shouldn't laugh, but it's fucking brilliant.
It's
Especially,
simple and effective.
yeah, and I think particularly when like you think about women in the domestic sphere, and she's stuck in this position because she was also an academic, but now they've had two kids, and it makes more sense that she stays at home because obviously she's missed then all the like publications that she might have had, so she can't get a foot in, even though she's got a degree from either Oxford or Cambridge, because she clearly, like, it's not made explicit, but they live in either Oxford or Cambridge, and she went to uni at the other. They just talk about the two sort of university towns, don't they? As almost as if they're interchangeable, which they are, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway.
Shuffling around.
So I thought that was interesting that it was part of the sort of domestic sphere, and that's a like really, I was going to say, easy way to start it off. The like, yeah, to poison his food, fuck it, why not?
It was swift and it was brutal.
Yes,
I
and he doesn't
just
even realize what she's done to him to start with.
No, well, that you start to you wonder, oh my God, is that what she's going to do? She talks about serving his from a separate pot. And I have to mention the news story that's going around at the moment in Australia, where this woman's just been charged with murder for like offing a load of her like in-laws and stuff, by making a beef Wellington with poisonous mushrooms, like death cap mushrooms or whatever. She doesn't in this book kill him, obviously. That's only the first punishment, but she does make him very, very sick, and then sort of goes, there's this really like really quite vivid scene where she goes to check on him and he's like in the bathroom being sick or whatever, and she just goes, yeah, I can tell him, yeah, I did that. I put something in your dinner.
And then
Yeah.
she makes him go to the seaside.
But tomorrow we're going out.
Yeah, it's like, fuck it, you'll be fine, get it, car. And again, I thought that like there was a bit of reclamation for her because she drive, and he's like, you don't drive, because it's always been the thing that she has sat in the back with the kids. And you're like, she's meant to be the one that's doing all the stuff. Like, why was this not 50-50? Why couldn't she drive sometimes and him sit in the back and entertain the kids? Ooh. Yes, I just want to talk about all the ways she hurts him, but the second one is
Oh
so
my God.
good. I gasped. Like,
I did.
and I sort of, I don't know like how much personal stuff to talk about here, but so my ex-husband cheated on me. This is not a like revelation, because I've written about it in Trauma Anthology, which was published by Dodo Inc. Also, it's on the divorce papers, so you know, like, if you want to
It's a
read
matter of
them.
public record.
It's on public record. I mean, I'm sure if he finds out I'm talking about it, he'll not be thrilled, but that's his problem, isn't it? I can't imagine he's ever going to listen to this, so we're all good. And yes, with someone he worked with, and honestly, I fantasized about like emailing her husband and going, do you know, la la la. So the thing that Lucy does is she gets Josh's phone, she works out what the code is. She goes through all these photos, eventually finds this folder, which is fucking labeled work. Like, what an idiot, that's got photos of him having sex with Vanessa in it. So she opens the faculty email, finds it. And this is the thing with like university departments, they always have a group, there's always group emails. She sends it to the whole, she sends a photo of him, in, like, literally in the middle of having sex with Vanessa to. The group email on Christmas Eve. Oh, it's just
His email address.
from his email
Oh,
address, yeah.
his, yeah. So it looks like he's the one that sent it.
It's just beautiful.
It's just beautiful. And honestly, the fact it just it made me disproportionately angry that he kept the photos, because by that point their affair's apparently over, and he's still got this folder of explicit photos, and that was the point where I was just like, oh yeah, fuck it, send them,
Yep.
send them,
Yep.
send them all, put them on Facebook, tag him.
It's so good. So there is a little bit of like personal sort of glee in this. But one of the other things that I thought was really interesting, so I'm not going to give away what she does to him at the end, but it's great. And it's not quite the end, because something like what happens to her is actually more interesting than what she does to him. But there's it keeps coming back to her parents and her parents, like her dad was violent, and I think if I remember rightly, he had at least one affair, if not more. And she keeps remembering that. And I thought that was really interesting about these cycles and how they're repeated, because if you've grown up in that sort of household, you then end up in that situation. And like, I'm extrapolating from what's in the book, because it's not, and this is all sort of therapy stuff, but it's that idea, isn't it, that you're used to that atmosphere. And so you end up recreating it in your own relationships. And I thought that was really well done, without it ever, there's none of that sort of therapy talk. It's just shown really bluntly. And you're like, you'd have to know that stuff to put it together yourself. But I think that's really well, like, commented on, I guess.
What she's really good at in what is a very slim book, actually, is the sort of minute details. She gets them so on the nose. There's like these times where Josh and Lucy are having, if not arguments, then certainly very intense conversations and about what's happened. And then one of the boys will appear and they kind of instantly snap into parent mode. There's a bit of, you know, as we had been for years, we were teammates, now classmates, we were learning or unlearning the same things. It was just this sort of, just this immediate switch out into, we are parents and this is what we do, and you know, you do this and you do that, you know, and that sort of thing. And I thought that was very, very realistically done and very, very well done. But the other thing I wanted to mention, you sort of alluded to, is that idea of female anger being passed down the line, this inheritance of female anger that is kind of grown as it passes from woman to woman. And in that sense, I think it's notable that she doesn't have any daughters. She has two sons, so the sort of line stops with her. But there's a bit where she talks about, you know, her grandmother, who was also sort of very angry about certain things. I used to imagine her anger as a parasite that lived in her stomach that passed through the wall of her womb to my mother, who passed it to me. This inheritance, and you can look at that from the kind of family line, but you can also, like, the inheritance of all women, as the generations of rage just get passed down and passed down and passed down. I thought was just fabulous. Really, she does it with such economy. Like she really kind of encapsulates those ideas with very few words. She's a fabulous writer.
Yeah, bloody poets.
There's also a line which I just a children's party like death is never real until it's happening, which is so accurate. So unbelievably accurate. And they're organizing this sort of big party for one of the boys, where it's sort of, they're still at that age where the done thing is to invite the whole class, and she's really hoping that, because it's the Easter holidays, that not everyone will show up, and then like 20 kids show up. And I had absolute flashback. The only time that I have done one of those big parties was for my daughter when it was her sixth birthday. Her birthday's in January, so I had no excuse in terms of the hopefully everyone will be away. People were very much there. It was like, you know, late January and everyone's waiting for a party. Hired the local hall, and her birthday party and her birthday was about 2 weeks after my mum died. And I absolutely channeled all my immediate grief, because I was in the middle of planning my mum's funeral and all this sort of stuff. And then I was organising this ridiculous fucking party in the church hall where, like, I seem to channel all my rage and grief and disbelief into making sandwiches, and had something like three times the number of sandwiches, even for the fact that I had 30 kids do it. Like, honestly, it was like the seventh ring of hell. And I just me and my ever increasing pile of sandwiches, just sandwiches multiplying around me, just eating them forever. Anyway, I'm not over it, as you can tell. but those parties are awful. I've never done it again.
I've never done one, I escaped this because my stepson, his mum used to do those parties, so I got out of them.
I have to say, I've never understood the people that do it for like first birthdays. Like, why
Oh.
you count? Why? Why? They're not going to remember.
Oh dear.
Sorry, I went off on a tangent there.
No, I mean, one of the things that I wrote down was like about motherhood. I know I've talked about it a little bit, but there's quite an amazing scene. So she thinks quite a lot about selfish mothers and whether she's selfish or for the way that, you know, she wants time to herself and all the rest of it. And there's a bit when they're in the car and the kids are arguing and she accelerates. And I was like, oh my God. Oh my God. And also that like judgment then, you've got your kids in the car, what are you doing? Yet men drive like dickheads all the time. So sorry, that was a bit hashtag all men, but you know what I mean. So yeah, I thought that sort of the bits where the rage sort of broke through when, and there's, oh, I mean, the party's amazing. The kids are on a fucking bouncy castle with swords, and obviously one of them gets hurt, obviously. And it's almost like it feels almost like it was deliberate, that she deliberately not thought through what was going to happen because she needed it to happen.
There's absolutely, you know, in a book that's full of kind of Greek and Roman myth with the harpies, you know, the idea of catharsis is absolutely there. You know, that kind of classical idea of catharsis is absolutely front and center. Also in the way that she hurts
Oh, yeah.
Josh, you know. But let's talk about the other party. They have this Christmas party.
Oh, God.
Excruciating. Where clearly all the neighbors know about Josh's affair, and she keeps overhearing people going, "Oh, I can't believe she went ahead with the party," and "Oh, I hear the woman was much older than him," and then catches one of her neighbors having sex with, well, her neighbor's husband, or like the
Yeah.
couple having sex like behind the shed. I was aghast. Not very polite.
Yeah, because you think it's gonna, she don't know where Jake is, so you think it's gonna be Jacob and Esther, don't you? But then the bit after that as well, so I can't remember his name, but one of Jake's friends is talking to her and she thinks that he fancies her. And then when she's talking to Jake about it afterwards, she realizes that he pities her. And it's so well done, the way that like she misreads the scene and like, yeah, and you're sort of following her as a reader, so you misread it as well. Yeah, I thought that was really
Which
well.
is sort of what happens in The Great Believers last week, right? Where the with Yale and Julio, where he thinks that Julio is it Julio? No, Julian. That's because I'm
Julian,
thinking of the other book, and where Julian, there's this bit where Julian, where Yale thinks Julian is sort of making eyes at him, and actually it's pity and sorrow and all of that sort of stuff
and
being
an
mistaken.
apology for shagging his boyfriend. Yeah.
That's the one, yeah.
God, what's all this infidelity we've been reading about? I don't know. I know before we get there, like, because I've read the first few pages, one of the books we talk about next week starts with, well, the narrator is a product of infidelity. Or no, he's not, is he? His dad disappeared because he was shagging someone else when his mum was pregnant with him, if I remember right. Anyway.
Well, we will discuss that next week.
More infidelity.
It's rampant. Absolutely rampant. I thought it was an absolutely brilliant book. I really want to read more by her. And I'm really glad I read this. And stunning cover.
Yes, I love the cover. It reminds me, there's a, well, I say this is going to be very vague. There's a, I think, European book, it's definitely translated, that has come out that has got a very similar picture on of the like swan wings over the woman's face. And I can't remember what it is, but I know I wanted to read it. So if anybody's listening and they know what I'm talking about, let me
I'm
know.
not sure what that is. I have to
I
look into that.
definitely remember seeing it, and but I didn't write it down, so that's on me, isn't
Yeah.
it?
Google swan face covers.
Yeah, and it's not like I haven't got enough books that I need to read, but anyway.
Oh, yeah, there is that as well.
Yeah.
So next week, Since you have mentioned it, next week we've got two translated novels. We are going to be reading Pedro Páramo by Juan Rulfo, which is translated by Margaret Sayers Peden, which is a Mexican novel. And we have Permafrost by Eva Baltazar, which is translated by Julia Sanchez. I think that's translated from the Spanish as well. Catalan. Yeah, Catalan poet, Eva Baltazar. Anyway, looking forward to those.
Yes, I believe both of those classify as novellas. I'm very excited. Two short
They're very
books.
slim.
Yes, exciting times.
I like the books.
Yes. In the meantime, you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. Our subscriber numbers have gone up on Spotify, so thank you, people that have subscribed on there. What else do I need to tell you? Oh, we're both on Instagram. So Kirsty is at Other Kirsty. I'm at Naomi Frisby. Otherwise, we will see you next week. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.